the slides that I've been showing with the sort of limited headings that they have should be available, and Dr. Valley and I will make sure tomorrow that if they're not already posted, that they will be. Okay, well, this is the last of the series of lectures that I'm giving, and I want to start with a relatively small technical topic before I go on to what are perhaps more important issues. A few things that may be showstoppers in terms of us going into space. It seems like every day that I give a lecture, I start off with something that's kind of topical. And the last time was hypoxia in aircraft, and of course WestJet helped us there. Well, today I'm starting with temperature control, and that's lacking in this room. So please bear with us if you can. Usual environment I wish to teach. It's not as the temperature may be a little high here, but of course, obviously, it's not anything like as high as one can sometimes achieve in space. You probably all know that in the vacuum of space. Yes, I'll try turning it up. I'm not familiar with this one, so I don't know where I'm going to get feedback. But you'll find out very quickly as I go up. Is that better? Okay, thanks. As I say, you're probably all aware that in the vacuum of space, if something is in the sun, it can get extremely, extremely hot. On the other hand, if it's in the shadow of something, it can get extremely cold. And the extremes are much, much greater than you would ever achieve on the ground normally. Now, of course, the astronaut is always in some kind of protective environment, either in a spacecraft or a spacesuit. And spacecraft work pretty well in this regard. They do maintain a generally decent temperature. They're well insulated and so on, and they work pretty well. Spacesuits are far from perfect. They have lots and lots of problems, and not the least of which is temperature control. I think I did mention to you that when you inflate a spacecraft, it tends to become quite rigid. And, that's why you run it at a reduced pressure. But even so, even when the pressure is reduced, every move you make takes a lot more energy than it normally would. You're always fighting. It's like you have bungee cords pulling on your limbs when you're trying to move your arms. And, of course, crew members might be doing some fairly heavy physical work as well. And what usually happens is that the crew members overheat. They can actually develop hyperthermia. Their core body temperatures can rise above what you would like to see. As well, they're sweating a lot as a result, and they tend to develop fluid and electrolyte imbalances. And remember, they're typically out for 6-7 hours, so it's a pretty bad environment. It can give you lots of time to get into trouble. You've got to get rid of this heat. You've got to get rid of the sweat also. And dealing with excess water in a spacesuit, condensing it and storing it is a bit of a technical trick, but it's not too terribly difficult to do. There are no physical real limits there. The problem is getting rid of heat. You might think that in space the problem would be heating somebody. No, it's not. It's cooling them. And the reason for that is because there are very few ways in which you can cool them. You can't conduct heat away. You can't, because there's no atmosphere. You can't convect heat away. I mean, if I'm standing here and I'm getting very hot, I'm conducting heat to the air around me, and it's being moved away, and cooler air is coming in by convection. Of course, none of this works in space. You only have two options. One is radiation cooling. That's the primary way of getting rid of heat in a spacesuit. Basically, just a black surface that radiates off heat. Very inefficient, and relatively ineffective. In a pinch, and especially particularly at the beginning, you use also evaporative cooling. You can, to a limited extent, because you don't have that much on board, you can basically boil water. And that, of course, requires heat, which is taken from inside the suit. And that'll give you a limited ability to cool as well. But the basic problem with the space suit, one of the basic problems with the space suit, is keeping it cool enough so that the person inside is comfortable. Now, paradoxically, At the same time as core body temperature is going up, you have to worry about frostbite. Now that's really limited to the fingers because they're not particularly well insulated in the gloves, because the gloves have to be flexible enough to be able to use your hands. The rest of the body is not is really not an issue. In fact, it's been necessary to put electric heater wires in the gloves, which can be turned on to warm the fingers. It'd be very nice on some days in the winter, I think, but it's still yet another kind of complication you have to deal with when you're talking about spacesuits. So other than heater wires, what else can you do? First of all, I'm going to try to get this thing going out here. And there are, okay, well, there's a lot of light in this room, but I think you can still see what I'm going to say here. You do two things. One is you use passive kinds of techniques. And the passive techniques would consist of making sure as much as possible of the suit is a very reflective white. And it has to be a special white that reflects infrared. So it's a very carefully chosen reflective surface to get rid of the excess sunlight. Because remember, you're going to have a problem with overheating, so you want to get rid of as much as you can. Now, obviously, there are other parts of the suit which are going to be, or of the person at any given time, they're going to be in the shadow, and they're very well insulated so that you don't lose too much heat and start freezing something. Beyond these passive techniques, you also, because they're not adequate, they're not good enough, you also have to distribute. You have to be able to redistribute heat from one part of a suit to another. And that's typically done with a garment like you see in the right-hand picture here, which consists of something that looks a bit like underwear, long underwear, but it has many, many tubes, fluid-conducting tubes that run through it, and a pump forces fluid through there, and it just basically picks up heat in one place and distributes it somewhere else. A neat kind of thing, but again, you've got pumps, you've got tubes, you've got all kinds of things that could leak and cause trouble, so it works. But it's just another complication of spacesuits. Even if you're in a sophisticated spacesuit, you're never going to have a perfectly comfortable day. There's always going to be some part of you that's hot, some part of you that's cold, and you just have to tolerate it for the length of time that you're out there. It's sort of not unlike skiing or doing a lot of other things that we do, where you're not always perfectly comfortable, but you're you kind of forget about it after a while. That's fine for a short while. It's not so good if you're inside a spacecraft, of course. And there, you have to keep temperature and humidity within a fairly narrow zone. There's sort of I talked before about a normal physiological range. Well, this is sort of a normal psychological range, if you will, because it really has nothing to do with physiology. And this is a graph that was worked out long ago for the cabins of aircraft. Of course, it equally applies to the cabin of a spacecraft. And what it plots is the temperature and on the vertical axis, vapor pressure, basically humidity on the horizontal axis. And it divides people's reactions into different zones. There's a so-called comfort zone in the middle, where you can see those slashes. That's the area in which it works, if you will. If you get beyond that, you get into ranges where you can tolerate it for maybe 12 hours, then only 4 hours, and then you really don't like it at all. And the same applies at both ends. The point of all this, though, is that there's a very narrow range into which you have to control temperature and humidity in a spacecraft, or anything else that you're existing in. It's a very narrow range, considering how far you could go one way or the other. There's another thing here which is which all of us have experienced, and that is if you look at the line at the top end of the comfort zone, the temperature goes down as you go up in humidity. We all know that. I mean, the more humid it gets, the more uncomfortable given temperature is. So that's why this box is kind of skewed down. So that's the aiming point. That box is the aiming point. Spacecraft, by the way, tend to be very humid places because condensing out moisture is not that easy a thing to do. They tend to be in the 70% or higher range. So it's a much smaller box for a spacecraft. They can be humid enough, by the way, that you can actually have blobs of water forming on cold surfaces. When the Mir space station was up, one of the jobs of the cosmonauts used to be to go around with a towel and mop up the large blobs of water that would form at certain places where they knew they would be, because those were the cold spots and that's where the water always condensed out. And you get these great wiggly jellyfish-like things, which are actually just big blobs of water that they had to mop up. Anyway, that having been said, there's one problem that's not obvious from here, but it's a bit of an issue. And that is, if you take a large number of people, probably more than we have in this room, and you put them at any given point within that comfort zone, it doesn't matter where it is, 5% of that group of people will not be happy. They'll say it's too hot, it's too cold, it's too humid, whatever. There is no common point where everybody is happy. You can't please all of the people all of the time. And, you know, in a spacecraft, you're not going to have individual temperature control. They're basically just going to have to get used to it. And, of course, we can. I mean, we adapt to the seasons very nicely. Right now we're, you know, adapting to more, you know, warmer temperatures. Yeah. No, what I said was that spacecraft tend to be very humid. And they tend to, there are good days and bad days depending on what's going on, but very often they're going to be to the right of the seven. You see, there's a bunch of lines coming down like that. Those are relative humidity lines. And you can see up at the top right, there's a 70% RH, a 70% relative humidity. That's what we normally think of in terms of humidity. So everything basically from that line over in the comfort zone is where you would be operating in a spacecraft, because they tend to be humid. It's not going to be like a desert. You know, we can all learn to live with different temperatures. Unfortunately, there are some environments to which we can never adapt. And these are the ones that are really going to cause us problems in spaceflight. And one of these certainly is the radiation environment that one is exposed to outside of the Earth's magnetosphere, or the magnetic field of the Earth. The radiation environment, I think, would be what most people consider to be one of three showstoppers. These are the ones that for which we have no solution, which we know we cannot tolerate as a species, and which we know are there. And one of these, of course, well, there's sort of two and a half, because one is this increased intracranial pressure and effects on vision that I mentioned earlier. That's still a little bit uncertain. We're not quite sure whether we can deal with that or not. Hopefully we can. Then we're down to two. Certainly, radiation is something that you cannot tolerate. End of story. We're all exposed to radiation right now. There's obviously low-level radiation all around us. It comes mostly from local natural sources, unless, of course, you happen to live in Japan, from dental X-rays and things of that sort. It's not very high-energy radiation. The dose typically is very low, and it varies depending on whether you have radon in the basement, radon gas or whatever. But just about everywhere, the natural radiation level is not that high. There's another issue, which is called linear. It's the biological effectiveness of radiation. You can't just take a physical measurement of radiation and extrapolate directly to its effect on us. You have to take into account how that energy transfers to us, and some kinds of radiation are worse than others. And there's a thing called linear energy transfer, which just takes into account the biological effectiveness. The radiation that we're experiencing now is not that high in terms of LHC, so it's not that terribly bad. If you go into space, it's a very different story. First of all, it's not normal background radiation that we get here. Rather, it's from galactic cosmic rays. It's from, if you're silly enough to go into the Van Allen belts, it's the concentration of radiation that you get in those belts. Or it's from solar flares, solar particle events, which can send out great bursts of radiation in some particular direction from our sun. A lot of this radiation has an extremely high energy, and the dose can be extremely high, and unfortunately also the linear energy transfer, its ability to damage us is also very, very high. So it's a very hostile environment. The only reason we get away with it right now is, of course, we're within the Earth's atmosphere and also the Earth's magnetosphere. And the combined shielding effect of those two is basically what keeps us from being turned into crispy critters. It's not a very big, very thick shield. I mean, if you go 10 miles up, you know, 10 miles from where we are right now, you wouldn't want to live there for very long because of the radiation. That's up around 50,000 feet or so. And, you know, high altitude aircraft at this point, it's a major issue of you know, how much radiation exposure can you allow for the crews who are up there every day. It was even more in the days of Concorde because it was up over 60,000 feet. And there, it was a very bad radiation environment for the crews. And in fact, the number of flights they could do was limited because of the radiation exposure. So, you know, it's really not very far away. Now, of course, when you go into go beyond the atmosphere, go beyond the magnetosphere into deep space, you don't have this shielding effect, and that's where you can run into problems. And I guess the next question is, well, how bad is it, and why do we worry about it? Okay, this is, you know, if you're going to be exposed to radiation, there are two things you need to know. First of all, you need to know how much can you accept. What are the limits? And the second question is, well, how much are you going to get? Are you going to approach these limits? And these are recommendations from the National Council on Radiation Protection, for radiation, for workers in the radiation industries, people like in power plants or dealing with medical isotopes or that sort of thing. And there are a number of points here that can be made, which I think tell us something about the radiation environment in space. First of all, limits. For a radiation worker, you're allowed 5 rem per year. Now, again, that's a measurement. It's one of several you can use, but it's one that measures the biological. It takes into account the biological effectiveness of the radiation. Typically, a radiation worker is allowed about 5 rems per year. Now, an astronaut is allowed 50 rems per year, and one might think that's because they have the right stuff. You know, they're so thick-skinned that the radiation doesn't get in or something. And, of course, normally, you know, they're normal people. They're just like you or I. And there's a very good practical reason why it's 10 times as high. And that is, if it was at 5 rem, nobody could fly. Because you're going to get more than 5 rems on a single flight. You know, even a short flight just in low Earth orbit. So the answer to that one is, well, you increase the limit, right? And it was set up at 50 rems per year. But that's based on a very careful calculation. It's based on a calculation that says at 50 rems per year, you will have a 3% increased risk of dying of cancer. Now, that may not sound all that terrible. It's a significant risk, but it's not all that terrible. But you add that to the 4% that I talked about earlier of, you know, dying in an accident, an explosion or whatever, you get a 7% risk of dying. If you become an astronaut, you have a 7% risk of dying from a job-related problem right off the top. And, of course, there are lots of other things, too. So it's a compromise to allow human spaceflight to occur, and one wonders just how, justifiable it is, but that's what it is. There's also a career dose. You can actually get more than your 50 rems over a period of several flights, over years. And what's interesting there is that the dose is 100 rems per career, which, by the way, is pretty well a single long-duration tour in space station. One. You're beyond your limit. So it's 100 rems per career for a young female. It's 400 rems per career for an old male. And there are two separate issues here. One is gender, of course. The reason being that radiation damage to the female reproductive system is much more serious than damage to the male, simply because ova are there from day one. They don't renew themselves. And if you damage one genetically, it's going to stay damaged. whereas sperm is turning over all the time, and so it's not nearly so so dangerous if you damage the male reproductive system with radiation. There's also, however, an age issue here, and this is a little more cynical. Basically, it says that if you're 55, you're probably going to die of something else. So, you know, you can afford to have a higher dose, because you will develop your cancer 10 years after you die, which obviously you're not going to at all. So, the normal requirement here is that in an older person, you can tolerate a bigger dose of radiation. Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, John Glenn went up when he was in his 70s, and normally the normal astronaut would be in the 40 to 50 year old range, I would think. There's obviously some out of both extremes, but you know, beyond both extremes. But these are senior people. I mean, it's, you send kids up, and you don't send geriatric cases up either, if you can avoid it. So they tend to be, you know, in that kind of range. Any 24-year-old that's ever flown. Young, very, very simple. It just doesn't work that way. Okay, so that's the story behind the recommended doses. What are you going to get? What do you expect to get if you actually go into space? Well, if you don't go to space, you and I, for example, would get about a third of a RAM per year with the natural background sources, a few X-rays and stuff like that. If you go to the surface of the Moon or Mars, you can expect to get about 25 RAM per year of radiation exposure. You're beyond the magnetosphere of the Earth, of course, and there's an atmosphere on Mars, but it's sufficiently tenuous that it doesn't really have any significant effect on radiation. Space station and on the way to Mars are twice as bad. They will expose you to about 50 rems per year, and that assumes, by the way, a quiet sun, no solar flares. You might wonder, first of all, why do you get half the dose on the Moon or Mars that you get on the way to the Moon or Mars? Well, the answer to that is pretty simple. If you're standing on the surface of a very big object like the Moon or Mars, half of your universe is shielded. It's behind the planet or Moon, and so you only get half the radiation dose. And that's to your advantage. Why do you get the same? I mean, space station orbits well within. It's 150 or so miles up. It's well within the magnetosphere. Why do you get so much radiation there, which is equivalent, really, to what you get in deep space on the way to Mars? Well, the answer to that is the Russians. The orbit that you go to depends on where you're launching from on the ground. Your orbit will always be tilted relative to the equator. And you try to launch as close to the equator as possible to get the minimum tilt. It's just an energy thing. The typical orbital inclination out of Kennedy Space Center is 22 degrees, something of that sort. However, if you put the space station up in a 22-degree orbit, the Russians couldn't get to it because they have to launch from something like 52 or 53 degrees north. So to satisfy the Russians, the orbit of the space station, the present space station, is inclined by over 50 degrees. Well, so what? I mean, it's more difficult to get there, yes, but you can do that. But it also puts the orbit periodically through something called the South Atlantic Anomaly, which is a kind of a tail of the magnetosphere which comes down much lower than the rest of it and has a lot of radiation. In fact, about 95% of the radiation exposure of a crew on space station is achieved simply by going through the South Atlantic Anomaly every once in a while, because you don't go through on every orbit. It's a particularly bad spot to go through, and it's simply because of, the Russians have to have that kind of inclination. It's still just 50, it's still just 50 rems per year, which obviously astronauts can tolerate, because we say they can. The one real, real concern on everybody's mind is what happens if there's a major solar particle event when somebody's on their way to Mars. It would be very easy. I mean, solar flares tend not to just emit energy in every direction. They tend to focus a burst of radiation in a particular direction. If it happens to be towards where that spacecraft is, it would be not at all difficult to get 1,000 rems a day of radiation exposure in the spacecraft. If that happens, you don't have to worry about cancer, because you'll be dead within a couple of days. That would kill you from just the acute radiation exposure very, very quickly, and not very pleasantly. These are the things we worry about if we're going to send somebody to Mars or anywhere else in deep space. There's no question that radiation exposure may be something that puts an absolute ability on our ability to move to other parts of the solar system or beyond, for that matter. It also suggests that if you're going to colonize another planet, and obviously that's something that's way off in the future, but if you are going to colonize another planet, it probably has to have a magnetosphere and an atmosphere, otherwise you probably can't survive there. Actually, it gets even worse than that, because the kind of radiation you get in deep space, as I've mentioned, is different from what you get on the ground. It's extremely high energy, and we're not really sure what the hazards of that high energy radiation are. They're bad, that much we can assume. But we don't know, are they worse? Are they significantly worse than the kind we're exposed to here? Does it scale linearly? There's all kinds of questions, and there have been a number of projects ongoing for years at Brookhaven in the States and Loma Linda University, where they have particle accelerators that can achieve, at least to a limited extent, the kind of environment that one would get in space, and they're checking the effect of that on biological materials and on whole animals. There's no real answers as yet. Unfortunately, we probably won't get real answers for quite a long time, because their budgets have been cut to the point now where they probably can't function anymore, and we won't know. We're going to get into a situation where we're going to be technically ready to send somebody to Mars, but we're not going to know if they're going to come back alive. And there's one other thing that's an issue, and that is that little bit at the bottom of the effects of weightlessness table that I showed you, and that is the effect on the immune system. We do know that immune function changes when you're in zero-G. We do not know whether that has an impact on anything, be it development of infections or, for that matter, cancer. And the thing that we worry about is that we have people here who are effectively being turned into AIDS patients. Their immune systems are seriously compromised. Then you radiate them in space a lot. Now, if you radiate an AIDS patient, they will develop tumors very quickly, and very, very bad tumors. So this is a theoretical possibility. There's certainly no proof that that's the case, but it is something that we worry about a great deal. Yes? En route is just on the way to. Yeah, when you're going there. When you're on the way to Mars, you're in deep space. There's no big body around or magnetosphere to protect you. Yeah. It varies. It goes in cycles, and we've just come out of a quiet phase, and we're into a phase of increased solar activity now. There have been a couple of very big flares in the last couple of months, which have messed up communication satellites in a couple of cases, and they can be big. I mean, these things are pretty impressive. They can even, I mean, there was one time when it knocked out half the electrical system in Quebec, because I won't go into the mechanism, but basically it created a huge spike of energy that went down the grid from the dams up north and took out an awful lot of the system. Oh, that's a solar particle event, solar flare.
Okay.
There's a lot of protons that come out and so on. It's just a fancier way of saying the solar flare. Okay, so what do you do? You can either end up with cancer, or you can get totally fried if it's enough radiation. What do you do to prevent that from happening? Well, on the ground, of course, if you have a radiation source, you provide shielding. anything in a hospital, that, you know, isotopes are in lead containers and that sort of thing. So can we actually produce a shield that would work in space? And the answer, bottom line, is no, we can't. And the reason for that is really a practical one. Either the shield that we have to have would either be too heavy, you know, if we made it out of lead, for example. I mean, you can just imagine putting thousands and thousands of pounds of lead into orbit. That's a huge, huge task, and it's not a very practical thing to do. It would either be too heavy or it could be too big. I mean, for example, hydrogen gas or water are very good shields. On a per-weight basis, in fact, they're better than lead. But the trouble is on a per-weight basis, because you end up with something that's so big that it's not practical either. Polyethylene is another one that people use. This is this illustrates another issue that is a problem when you shield a spacecraft. And what it's based on actual measurements on the ground. And so there's some limitations because of energy levels and so on, but basically it's real data, and it predicts the REM exposure per year of an astronaut as a function of how much shielding you have on the spacecraft, up to a foot thick of solid aluminum. Totally impractical. You couldn't ever have that, but that's an extreme case. Well, what does it do for you? Well, and oh, by the way, it also assumes a solar minimum, which means a quiet sun, not one that's generating a lot of flares. It takes out heavy ions rather nicely. It doesn't do anything for protons, the area there. That just really has no effect. And the worst thing is that it causes the generation of secondary particles. When the radiation hits the shield, things annihilate and emit secondary radiation, neutrons, other secondary particles, and they actually increase. It gets worse as the shielding increases, which is sort of counterintuitive, but that's the way it is. I mean, this has been measured in the Mir space station. It turned out that the X-ray environment inside the spacecraft was many times worse than outside the spacecraft. And it was simply because of the structure of the craft being hit by radiation, and the secondary X-rays in this case were being emitted. So shielding is not that great in a spacecraft. Now, there is one case where it probably would be a good thing, and that's if you're on the moon, if you're on another planet, and you have a lot of material to work with. You can sort of dig yourself a cave and use a huge amount of material, and that'll be an effective shield. So that is a bit of a rider on the shielding question. If you have enough of it, you're okay, but you got to be in a situation where you can actually do it in a practical sense, like on another planet, not in a spacecraft. If shielding is not the answer, can you just create your own little magnetosphere? Can you generate a magnetic field around your spacecraft? No, it's not a panacea in any case, because it doesn't do much for neutrons, but it also would require far too much energy, far too much mass, according to if we built one using today's technology. It isn't a practical way to do it at all, as it turns out. Now, if you were in the military, you'd say, radiation? Well, we'll just give them a pill and they'll be fine. They've actually, to an extent, it's a reasonable thing. If you can develop a drug that minimizes the effect on DNA of radiation exposure, you might be able to reduce the effect of radiation on that person. They've been trying to do it ever since the first atomic bomb went off. They've never succeeded, nor has anyone else for that matter. Drugs do not protect one against radiation exposure. And I don't think that's a course we should even think of going down, because it just doesn't work. And there's not even a good theoretical reason why it should. I guess the bottom line of all this is that we're really in a very, very special niche of the universe. I mean, in everything we know about the universe, we obviously a lot of things we don't know about in terms of other planets and so on. But certainly in the area we know, we have this, few mile thick film around this planet in which we can live because of radiation. Get beyond that, you can't. It's as simple as that. Unless you dig yourself, a burrow in a hole somewhere in the ground. But to be outside and actually function the way we normally do, this is the only place we can do it. Okay, that's my bit of proselytizing about radiation and how bad it is. I mean, it's a real problem. This is something that's going to have to be taken into account if we're going to another planet. There are other things, and I'm going to go on now to talk about things that are particles that are a little bigger than protons or whatever. And that would be things like micrometeoroids and debris which are in Earth orbit. This is an issue that, to an extent, is true anywhere you go. Varies depending on whether you're in an asteroid belt or, especially if you're in low Earth orbit where we've got so much junk up there. But basically, there's a lot of junk. The space is not empty. You have, of course, meteoroids which are chunks of, iron or rock which are zinging around out there. You have micrometeoroids which are like grains of sand size. And in reality, there are tons, literally tons, of extraterrestrial material which enter our atmosphere every day. Very often it'll create one of these meteors, a shooting star, most of which we don't see because it's daytime or we're not looking or whatever. But the material does come into our atmosphere quite regularly. Of course, if it hits something before it gets, that's where the problem lies. So there's a lot of natural junk out there. Unfortunately, there's a lot of man-made junk. And this is one of the sad parts of the history of the space program. There are, especially in low Earth orbit, there is so much debris out there now for example, the space station has had to make two evasive maneuvers in the last 3 weeks to avoid potential collisions with stuff that was flying around. The sources are varied. Some of them are just accidents. It used to be that people didn't understand that if you sent a rocket up to launch a satellite, that the upper stage would have to be fully depressurized and all the fuel would have to be dumped out of it before you just left it there, because otherwise there was a very real chance it would explode, and some of them did. And an exploding upper stage leaves a lot of garbage up there. There have been more stupid things, such as anti-satellite tests, where people shot up rockets to blow up satellites. Now, people normally say, well, the Chinese did that. But the Chinese were the last to do that. The Americans did it first, the Russians did it second, and the Chinese did it third. And all three of them created one heck of a mess of thousands and thousands of chunks of debris that are floating around, and many of which won't come into the atmosphere for thousands of years if they're in a high enough, stable enough orbit. Most of the stuff that's up there is pretty small, very small, the size of a grain of sand or maybe even smaller. But it's a bit deceptive because of the extreme velocities at which these things are traveling, they possess enormous energy. Remember that, from high school physics, energy is proportional to the square of the velocity. So if something goes twice as fast, it has four times the energy. And obviously it scales up. So you've got huge amounts of energy that have to be dissipated when even a small particle hits something. Now, there are, one might expect, although that's just an artist's impression on the left of the Leonid meteor shower, and on the right, an actual photograph of the Leonids taken from above. Now, of course, there's a story in that, because if you're looking down on the meteors, it means that stuff came by you, or its friends came by you. So, this is an idea of how much junk there can be. Okay, this is what I wanted to get to, which is actually, this is a picture of the radiator inside the cargo bay of the shuttle. I don't know if you know how it works, but the cargo bay has big doors that fold open, and immediately there are radiators that fold open on top of those doors. Again, it's a question of how do you get rid of heat in a vacuum. It's not an easy thing to do. The radiators are very big, and they're pretty strong. This picture here is of a hole in a radiator. It was caused by a small particle that hit it in flight, went right through it. In fact, it hit the other side as well and kept on going, never stopped. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, that happens regularly. Virtually every big object in space and some smaller ones have been hit by something at various times. Shuttle's been hit, station's been hit, Mir was hit, something called LDEF, which was a long-duration exposure facility, which was like a school bus-sized passive satellite that was there to study this kind of thing. When it came back, the plates that they used, they had big plates, and they had coatings on them to count hits. Well, when they got it back, it was a bit delayed from what it should have been, but it was, after a couple of years, there was no coating. These things had been scoured clean by being sandblasted, basically, by the junk that was up there. What do you do about this? Because this is not something you want to, you know, have happen to you. Well, it depends very much on the size of what you're going to get hit by. If you're talking about something the size of a grape or bigger, you know, not a very big item, but something the size, you know, this big around. Station gets hit by that, shuttle gets hit by that, you get hit by that, that's it. It's catastrophic. There's nothing you can do to prevent total disaster from something like that. It would break the trust of the space station, which possesses so much energy. That sounds terrible, but on the other hand, you know, you don't worry if you drive from here to Ottawa at early in the morning in a Volkswagen, you don't worry if there's a moose, you know, it's going to suddenly come out of the bush. I mean, it might, and you certainly can't develop a Volkswagen that can deflect a moose. But you know that statistically the chances of something terrible happening are fairly small. And you can also, if you know it's there, you can avoid it. And that's what space station does. If debris that's in low Earth orbit is tracked by radar, there are tens of thousands of items that are on, you know, that are cataloged. And if they know that one is coming close to the space station, they will maneuver the station a lower altitude to avoid it. That's happened twice in a few weeks, just to avoid various pieces of junk that were coming around. Now, the problem, though, is as the size goes down, the probability of a hit goes up, because as the items get smaller, there are many, many, many more of them. And probably the thing that you worry about the most is something that's about the size of a grain of rice or a pea, that, you know, relatively small. Trouble with them is you can't track them very well with radar, but they possess a lot of energy. And these are the kinds of things that if they hit, some things you can protect. The shielding on space station is pretty good, and it'll absorb the energy of most hits like that. If it hits a vulnerable spot, you might get a hole that you're going to have to fill, if you can get at it, because, of course, there's a lot of equipment that you have to get by to get to the outer wall. But there are ways of doing it. The problem, of course, is that if you're in a spacesuit, there's no way you can protect yourself against that. And if you get hit by a particle that's the size of a grain of rice, you will get a decompression, but that doesn't matter, because that's gone right through you, and it won't even slow down. And that is one of the reasons why EVAs, these spacewalks, if you will, they're limited to the greatest extent possible because they're dangerous. They're dangerous because of the bends, they're dangerous because of temperature problems, they're dangerous because of potential mechanical failures of the suit, and they're dangerous because somebody might get hit by something, and that would be a very, very bad situation. Now, if you get small enough, you're not so badly off, because there you can actually use a couple of methods to protect. Now, I'm talking about stuff the size of a grain of sand or smaller. Sometimes you can just use sheer physical strength. I mean, the visor on a spacesuit, for example, is typically made out of polycarbonate, which is, let's say, it's a layered thing, but one of the main layers is polycarbonate, and that's or Lexan. It's a very, very tough material. It will tolerate an impact of that sort, deflect a little, but not get broken. You can't do that on the body of the suit, and there's a neat technique that I'll just mention there, which is called layering. If you build a suit in multiple layers and a tiny particle comes in at huge velocity, when it hits the first layer or two, it'll vaporize. It simply heats up so much that it turns into a gas as it goes through. Now, it'll puncture those first couple of layers, but then the subsequent layers just get hit by a puff of gas, basically, and the energy is distributed over a much bigger area, and it'll tolerate that. So that's the way in which the space suit gets away from the issue of perforation due to very small particles. Okay, I don't have a whole lot more time here. I'm just going to mention a couple of other issues that we have, one of which is just a technical issue, the other of which is a really bad one. The technical issue is the fact that if you're going to go to Mars, you have to be in a closed environment. This sounds simple. All you have to do is recycle everything. You have to, have all your systems that'll deal with food, with water, with waste material, with trace contaminants. You can't allow, chemical off-gassing. You can't allow Velcro particle. Velcro is a terrible material for long-duration spaceflight because it sheds small particles, just the size that get into the lungs. All these things have to be taken into account. And, basically a closed environment is nothing more than a whole bunch of systems that interact, and you can draw them out on a piece of paper and it looks fine. Just try and make it work. Everything has to work with 100% reliability, 100% efficiency, and nobody has ever achieved that. Nobody's even come close to it, in fact. There was a somewhat scandalous effort in Arizona where they claimed that they were actually managing to have a closed system. It turned out it wasn't as closed as they said it was. Beyond that, nobody has really seriously claimed that they've ever managed to deal with create a real closed ecological system. It's a real challenge. It's a technical challenge, and that's the kind of thing that engineers can work on and scientists can work on and actually beat down. So that's okay, but we're not there yet. The last problem, and this is what I think a lot of people consider to be the real showstopper of spaceflight, would fall under the sort of general category of psychosocial issues. The problem is basically that, spacecraft are very, very small and very, very isolated places. And we have a history of how people behave in that kind of environment, from nuclear submarines, from the Arctic research station, Antarctic research stations, and so on. And it's not very good. In fact, you would anticipate problems from past history, and we've had problems in the space program. One of these is the lay term for it is called cabin fever. Now, cabin fever is something that was first described in cabins in the far north, where somebody would suddenly just go berserk and run out the door, probably not with no clothes on, and go running off into the woods and never be seen again. It's a kind of extreme psychological break that happens, and people behave irrationally, often violently. As I say, this has happened. This has happened not only in Antarctica, but it's also happened on the Mir space station. There was an example of a flight engineer who got into trouble, and they had to make an emergency re-entry because this was a real life-threatening situation that they had to deal with. Another problem that one might have to deal with is acute clinical depression. Now, depression is one thing, but a really serious depression is something else. This also happened. This was on a shuttle where a payload specialist who had spent many years working on a particular experiment. A payload specialist is just is an astronaut, but not a professional astronaut, somebody who goes up for one flight to do a particular job. And he went up to use this piece of equipment. It became very evident immediately that it wasn't going to work, and the reason was obvious, and he got into a serious depression. He became suicidal, and they had to put a 24-hour suicide watch on him. This is not the kind of thing you want to have happen in shuttle. It would be possible to pop the hatch in flight on an emergency, if you did the right thing, and could kill everybody. So needless to say, he was put on a watch. Now, if it's in the shuttle or a space station that's orbiting the Earth, that's one thing. If you're 2 months out on a year-long trip to Mars, what do you do? And I think that's the biggest concern. The real problem is that these people who had their problems in space, it wasn't predicted. And I couldn't, nor could anyone else, predict who else it's going to happen to. And that's that's the danger, because we just don't know what's going to happen. all I can say is I don't think if I had an opportunity to choose the crew that was going to Mars, I don't think I'd take it, because I really wouldn't want to have to take on that responsibility, because I couldn't possibly tell who the right people were. Okay, so the final question then, which I guess I started with, is, can we colonize another planet? I think there are lots and lots of reasons why we should, why we will, at some point in the far future. We're just not quite ready to do it now. And, if you look at it realistically, it may very well be that, the colonization of another planet will not be by us, but it'll be by the bacteria that we leave behind on that planet when we visit it, or some very much more primitive, what we would consider a primitive organism. They can probably adapt. They haven't gone far enough down the evolutionary path that they can't go back and adapt to something else. We can't adapt very, very well at all. So really, I think the colonists will not be Homo sapiens. It's going to be some bacteria or something like that. I guess my final word is when you look at what we as a species have done to this planet, that may not be a bad thing for the other planet. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.